This is Writer's Voice. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
Both the great war leaders, Roosevelt and Churchill, were much more interested in fighting Hitler with arms and bombers than they were in allowing Jews into their own countries.
That's Nicholson Baker. We talked to him about his latest book, Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization. It said, in the fog of war, the first casualty is truth. Is it possible that our notion of World War II as the good war is more propaganda than truth? Or that Allied leaders Winston Churchill and Franklin Delano Roosevelt were not as heroic as we've been led to believe? And is pacifism the answer to threats of conflict, even from murderous madmen like Hitler? My guest Nicholson Baker doesn't so much give the answers as pose these questions in his acclaimed new book, Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization. In his fiction, Baker is a master of telling detail and nuance. But Human Smoke isn't fiction. Rather, Baker painstakingly combed through newspaper stories, diaries both published and unpublished, and other eyewitness accounts to the run-up to and early days of World War II. He gives almost a day-by-day reckoning of how the world was drawn into a war that killed 50 million people, most of them civilians. Baker employs a matter-of-fact tone that only serves to heighten the cavalier disregard for the human consequences of war by leaders on all sides of the conflict. I spoke with Nicholson Baker last week. Nicholson Baker, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Your book, Human Smoke, is subtitled The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization. Could you say why you chose World War II, the beginnings of World War II, as the end of civilization?
Well, I think that I quote a couple people in the book who say after Pearl Harbor, that the precious treasure of our civilization is about to be swept away. I think people living through this time in Warsaw, say, or in London, watching London burn, all over the world, felt as if a kind of restraint had been lifted and that a level of public brutality was going on that was really very close to feeling like the end of civilization. Now, obviously, civilization heals over after that. So the subtitle is referring to what it felt like to the people living through this catastrophe and coming to the edge of a cliff at the end of 1941, which is when the book stops.
You know, I've been to Europe, and in France, for example, people refer to the Great War as World War I. And many people think of World War I and World War II as the same great war, and that somehow the end of civilization predated that. I mean, we have the genocides of Armenia. We can talk about even the Mongols, or, you know, genocides, atrocities. Civilizations have fallen before. Is there something special about this one?
Well, I think that one reason for saying something so strong is that this beginning part of World War II, the end of civilization, is to counter a kind of overly simple, heroic view of the war, which is that the West fought the war in order to save civilization, and that, in fact, successfully saved civilization. I think one of the implications of this book is that the kind of catastrophe that happened was the result of a massive military response to a horrific military threat. So that the war itself was truly a way of suspending civilized behavior. But yes, of course, all through history, there have been unbelievably awful wars and paroxysms. But I think if you flew over history as an eagle and look down, of course, you're going to see many green, peaceful patches. It's not like we as a species are just tearing each other up. But you're going to look and you're going to see this five-year period as probably the low point, I think, of human behavior, because it was a systematic brutality, state-supported brutality on a level and with a comprehensiveness that had never existed before. Even the First World War were these enormous armies paralyzed, trapped in front of each other and dying, but you didn't have civilian carnage the way you did in the Second World War. So I think it's a legitimate way to look at this period.
There are no real heroes here. In fact, I think your two main protagonists, if one could call them that, are Churchill and Roosevelt. Mm. And in many ways, they themselves exemplify what you talk about, a disinterest in civilian casualties. In fact, a willingness to use civilians as pawns in order to prosecute war.
I'm afraid that that does seem to be true over and over again. Obviously, we have to keep uppermost in our minds, however, that none of this would have happened if Adolf Hitler hadn't been the paranoid nut horror show that he was. He's the obvious bad guy that we can all contentedly agree was the source of all the trouble. If Hitler had never arose in Europe, there never would have been this resurrection of the career of Winston Churchill. It was the feeling that you needed a really tough, old British Empire warrior to fight against this terrifying figure who was threatening the British Empire. So I don't want to take anything away from the horribleness of Hitler by looking at the people who became the leaders who went against him. But it is true that, and I've always loved reading Churchill's speeches. I didn't know what a bloodthirsty man he really was in this phase of his life. Obviously, he had many phases. In fact, he had depressions, but this was a manic phase in which he was acting really something like a maniac, and we have to accept that and fold that into our knowledge of the time.
Say more about that.
Well, Churchill is a brave guy in a sense. He's also a brilliant speechwriter. He was very combative person, and his notion of resisting the Hitlerian menace was to do it in a different way from the First World War. As you mentioned, there are many continuities between these two wars, and he was the leader of the British Navy in the First World War, and his attempt there was to starve Germany into a state of submission. And I even quote that in the book because it's important to the way he approached Germany the second time around. So the first kind of response was institute a very strong blockade. As soon as Churchill took power in May, he tightened the blockade of Europe and actually removed the ability of American food relief agencies to get food to Poland. He wanted to starve Europe into a state of revolt. And that is one thread of his response. And then the other thing, which is also, I think, equally bloodthirsty, is his desire to fly over the field of battle, past German armies, because armies are hard to bomb, and find the centers of German industry. So his decision on the very first cabinet meeting was to bomb the Ruhr Valley, where there were lots and lots of German civilians. And what that meant was a kind of nightly, low-intensity war of sleeplessness and terror. And I just think that that was, of course, he thought it was, or said that it was calculated to make the Germans rise up against the evil dictators who were running the country. The net result of it was, though I think you can at least make a case for this, is that it united Germany behind Hitler. Any country that's attacked, its civilians terrorized, then falls in line behind the most extreme, most militaristic leader around. And that's, I think, what unfortunately happened. You could actually make a case that this decision to, as one of the Royal Air Force founders said, to keep the Germans out of bed and keep the sirens blowing, that decision to go after civilian centers night after night was really a gift to Hitler's government.
Like it was a gift to Milosevic in the 1990s.
Well, yeah, you can, I mean, I think it's always true that that if things fall on people and blow up on their heads from the sky, they get extremely angry, extremely irrational. A flood of xenophobia flows through the country. Look at what happened in 9/11. Two buildings horrifically came down and burned, and it was a firebombing, really. And the immediate reaction was to lock up lots of people who were foreign, to suspend laws of due process, and to invade two countries. I mean, it was an absolutely classic irrational rage response. And the precedent for that is in every earlier bombing attack. It's just something specific about things falling randomly from the sky that really provokes civilian rage. And the Second World War is the classic example of that. It's not the good war. It's the war that shows why that way of waging war is the worst possible one.
Well, what struck me as we talk of 9/11 and Yugoslavia is how much these tactics were set by World War II. You talked about Churchill instituting the policy of blockade, and really what we're talking about with blockade is we're talking about the starvation of women and children and men, civilian populations. You talked about the bombing, and in the book you also trace the development of this long, slow bombing to firebombing. I mean, the terrible firebombing that was a taboo subject really until just a few years ago when W.G. Zabel talked about, yeah, I think for the first time, about the firebombing of Germany. And Iraq as well. You say it's bombing is seen as pedagogy.
Mm. Yes, I think that that was a theme that really came from the British Empire. And a notion that they came to call air control, which was developed by Churchill after the First World War, when the British Empire was overextended, it was controlling a good percentage of the globe, and they had many unhappy villages all over the place, in the Middle East, in Africa, in India, the northern frontier, some of which is now Afghanistan. And their response with air control was to warn a tribe and say, you must do what we want you to do, and if you don't, we will bomb you. And then they would fly over, 20 planes or so, and they would and bomb the village. And that was supposed to be a cheaper way of controlling the British Empire than with large standing armies. And so the same method of air control then kind of metamorphosed into the idea that you could get Germany to do what you wanted it to do by aerially. And what Churchill said was that, oh, for instance, when the Italians leapt into the war, he said, well, now we must begin by air bombing several northern cities of Italy, because the Italians must know what war means. And the way to teach them what war means, he thought, was by bringing the war to the cities. Otherwise, it's just a news report about an army. So bombing was civilian populations, for Churchill, was a way of communicating via death and destruction and ruin what was going on, what should have been going on, with two armies clashing somewhere on the front. He didn't want armies to clash on the front because that had worked out very badly in the First World War.
So that civilians become the target, in fact, you're saying.
And I, of course, object to that, and I have strong feelings about all these things. But I didn't want to have the book, Human Smoke, be a tract to try to argue for pacifism or to say head-on that these things led to these things. I wanted instead the book to be a collection of broken fragments that have very little of my own voice in them. But I hope give a reader the sense of the suffering sense of what it was like to live through this period and to be confused by it and to have to make up theories as you go along and then abandon them and make other theories, because I think that's truer to what it's like to live through something as enormous and really frightening as a war than to have a nice, neat, big story that sounds heroic and good but is actually inadequate to the misery that was taking place at the time.
And there are a lot of shockers in this book that really change the perspective, change the mind. And we're talking with Nicholas Baker. His book is Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, the end of civilization. You know, just to talk a little bit about how you do the book, I found it extraordinarily powerful because you stitch together this tapestry in the most matter-of-fact of voices. And I would just like to read one short paragraph, or perhaps you could. Do you happen to have the book there?
I do.
Oh, great. On page 257, the middle paragraph seemed to really encapsulate in a very concentrated form all the helplessness, the hopelessness, and in such a matter-of-fact way, crystallize the suffering of this war. Maybe you could set us up. It's that middle paragraph about the Jewish refugees from Germany and Austria going to Haifa. Give us just a brief background and then read that paragraph.
Yeah, sure. A group of Jewish refugees from Germany and Austria were put on a boat in the harbor of Haifa, Palestine. With Churchill's approval, British forces were deporting the Jews from Palestine, where they'd arrived illegally after many hardships. The English planned to take them to Mauritius, a small island in the Indian Ocean not far from Madagascar. It was November 25, 1940. Two saboteurs from Haganah, a Jewish paramilitary group, blew a hole in the boat with a mine in order to keep it from leaving. The boat, which sunk, was called the Patria, and the disaster was called the Patria disaster. More than 250 people died. The survivors were taken to a British prison. One of the ironies, I guess, of the war, of this terrible set of horribly, unbelievably difficult to comprehend events, is that you have Jews trapped in Germany, trapped because of a not the fanatic anti-Semitism of Germany itself, but of the more genteel kind of familiar anti-Semitism of America and England, that there was no way for Jews to get out of Germany in any numbers, and the people who were trying to get them out, the Quaker relief organizations and others, just encountered this obstacle of that there was no way the borders were going to be opened or the quotas were going to be lifted. So there's this tremendous need to get out. And here are a group of Jews on a boat trying to get out to Palestine, but the British have suddenly changed the rules. So the first deaths that happened in a strange way from British action in the Second World War were the deaths of Jews who were trying to escape to Palestine from a boat where they were once again trapped.
And the Jewish paramilitary, the Haganah, also seemed to be less than interested in the lives of their compatriots.
Well, are you, and it's just never a good idea. I mean, I think that it's worth saying things that are really sound really simple and naive, like what Jeanette Rankin said when she voted against the war resolution after Pearl Harbor. Killing more people won't help matters. It never works to fight an evil with an evil. It just compounds the evil, increases the total level of hate and violence, and leads to retributions and escalations that go on infinitely until there's some sort of truce or armistice or a collapse from exhaustion. So yes, the Jewish paramilitary groups who chose to use violence in making their point were also in error. And the method of this book is to try to look at each action, like this one, but there are hundreds and hundreds, as a separate action, and ask, who made the mistake here? Who is actually making things worse, and who is making things better? And not to come up with some gigantic balancing scale and say, one nation was bad, i.e. Germany, and of course it was bad, and therefore the nation that opposed it, England, in the beginning, was good. Because a nation is just a fiction. There are a bunch of people sitting in a war cabinet making decisions. There are people flying in airplanes making decisions. There are people writing impassioned letters to the editor saying, don't bomb by night. They're making the decision to write that. And all of those individual acts are what makes up a historical convulsion like this.
And it really feels as if you are bearing witness, simply bearing witness to these stories. That's part of, I think, the power of your book, Human Smoke. Nicholson Baker say, just briefly, tell our audience, tell us about your sources. You consulted no sources that weren't readily available to anybody who reads English. Is that right?
Well, right. I don't think the book should be that I, as an amateur historian, or anybody going to the library, should be prevented from trying to come up with some complicated sense of what happened. In fact, I feel I kind of have an obligation to do this. I have worked extensively with unpublished sources and archives, and I was, in fact, in the middle of writing a book about a much smaller subject that uses all unpublished archival sources. But this one, it's important to work with what is actually, in some sense, in plain sight. So what was on the front page of the New York Times, or sometimes in the back pages of the New York Times, what could people read at the time? What were diarists saying? I mean, the real heroes, I think, of this book and the real heroes of World War II were nonviolent people, and I mean people like the diarist Victor Klemper, an entirely lovable, great human being. The title of his book in English is I Will Bear Witness. I mean, he is the true bearer of witness. And it comes down to how he muddles through, and when the government repossesses his car, and the coffee ration in Dresden versus the coffee ration in Cologne, which is being more heavily bombed, and therefore the government gives people there more coffee. Just that, what was he doing was not saying, I'm going to get together with some of my friends, we're going to sharpen our swords and sabotage some tank or something. He said, I am going to write something, the best thing that I can possibly write about this brain-scrambling time that I'm living through. And that's greatness. So I give him and another diarist, Mihail Sebastian, who lived in Budapest, the last word in the book, because I think that they are the true heroes.
Well, it's interesting that you characterize Klemper as a great human being, because I think he became one in the course of his wartime diary. He kept diaries both before the war from the 1920s and also up until his death, all of which have been published. And in reading the very first parts of the I Will Bear Witness, the diaries of the war, he comes across very much as the kind of person he had been before, which was a fairly petty, kind of backbiting academic.
Ah, yeah.
And he really attains an incredible dignity through the power of bearing witness. And for you, I wonder, for your own experience in this, I mean, this is a painful and yet inspiring, I have to say, book to read. I mean, it's not painful in the sense that you want to put it away, but really in the sense that you are just moved powerfully by the suffering. What was your experience in putting these witnesses to paper?
Well, I found that when I needed to have voices or heroes or people to admire, and I was deeply disappointed by people whom I formerly did admire, like Harold Nicholson and also Churchill himself, and so I would look around for other people, and I sometimes would get into the writing of the book, let's say 2 intense months of work on it, and I would just be visited with a kind of a terrible paralysis of not being able to go on, because it seemed too awful. But then I would find some person who just seemed like a fresh voice of rationality. Vera Brittain in England was one of them, who just seemed extraordinarily brave, and I thought that it was inspiring to be able to quote certain people and to realize that I could possibly rescue a different way of looking at what was happening that has been lost, maybe because, I mean, there have been studies of people who resisted the war in advance of, but they are all sort of self-contained. They're removed from what was actually going on. So this is an attempt to put them back into their actual place when when Shaw and some other people say, look, let's stop bombing Germany by night. This is a mistake. I wanted to look up what did people say in the House of Commons about that, and how did people react, and who was bloodthirsty in reaction, all those questions. So it was one of those feelings in writing the book of going back and forth of sometimes being just terribly sad about or shocked, outraged, and sometimes feeling that I'd found some new people to love and admire.
Vera Brittain, these were voices in the run-up to war as well as in the early stages. Do you have a quote that you might give us from Vera Brittain?
Well, there's a moment which really struck me. I think it was in 1941, but it may have been late in 1940, and she's lying in bed, and she hears the British, the Royal Air Force, flying overhead.
And tell us first who she is.
Okay, yeah. She was a fairly well-known writer who decided that she really, it was her duty to resist the hate images, as she called them, that were being propagated and the kind of language that was being, that was resurrected in the beginning of the Second World War. The word Hun, which was, of course, the big World War One word, was suddenly back in play. And she wanted to, she knew she would never stop Britain from this kind of war that it was waging, but she wanted to slow it down. So she started this thing called A Letter to Peace Lovers that went out. She published it in the bathroom of the Peace Pledge Union. I think she had a tiny office, and I mean, it was really difficult to be opposed to the government's policy at that point. Members of the Peace Pledge Union were arrested. It wasn't an easy time to say anything critical of the government, but especially to say anything critical of the war effort. That's who she was. She was lying in bed and listening to these bombers fly over, and she said, you know, she just thought of how many German children would be dead by the morning. And, of course, she had heard German bombers fly over to England. And she said, you know, it's horrible to think of the deaths that the British have experienced. But it's despicable to think that we are doing that to our enemy. And that's I think, one of the impulses in writing this book is the word we. Because I'm an Anglophile and love English literature, feel a bond to England that I just simply don't have with Germany. I don't have it. So when I think of a we, I think of the United States and England together. And I hold these two countries to a higher standard. I don't want us to be firebombing Tokyo. I don't want us to be developing, you know, the uranium bomb, now called the atom bomb. I think that these were terrible things. And I'm not surprised that the Nazis were beasts, but I don't hold them to that level. But I do think the way Vera Brittain thinks, I think it's despicable to visit on an enemy the kinds of things that it would do to us.
We're talking with Nicholson Baker about Human Smoke. Stay tuned for more of our interview with Baker after the break. You're listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. My guest is writer Nicholson Baker, and we're talking about his latest work, Human Smoke. It's composed of short, pithy paragraphs, each of which zeroes in on a telling detail about World War II, from the run-up to it, beginning in the 1920s, to the end of 1941 with the entry of the U.S. into the war. Another thing your book really chronicles is the escalation. Churchill, for example, unleashes this terrible bombing and the starvation blockade of Germany before Britain itself is attacked. Roosevelt also, you know, my hero Roosevelt, has a terrible part to play. You know, I think I knew that Churchill was kind of a bastard, but if I can say that on the air. But I didn't think Roosevelt was one. And I found it kind of interesting to see how the policy, we've referred to the policy of not allowing Jews in, yeah, how that, in fact, paved the way, in some sense, for the extermination of the Jews. I wonder if you could say that. And actually, I want to preface it with something. I read a review of your book in The New Yorker by Louis Menand. Mm-hmm. And I found it really kind of startling how he needed to trivialize
much of your treatment of Churchill and Roosevelt. And he says, for example, that Roosevelt, quote, Roosevelt seems to have once made a prejudicial comment against the Jews, which completely ignores the context, and I think it was more than once anyway, but it ignores the context of how his attitude towards the Jews helped to pave the way. It didn't cause it, but it abetted the extermination. I wonder if you could trace that out for us.
Well, I think abetted is a good word because, first of all, literally, it made things infinitely worse because even though Eleanor Roosevelt is the one who says these very straightforwardly anti-Semitic things early, and I quote one of them, unpleasant things that are sort of her class, by 1938, when it's obvious that something catastrophic is going on in Germany, Roosevelt, talking to one of the Quaker relief workers that are part of this book, Eleanor Roosevelt is saying, writing a letter to her husband, can I perhaps go on record to support this relief act that would allow in 20,000 Jewish children? And he says, it's okay for you to say it, but I'll just hold off on saying that I support it. And then he says nothing. The problem with that is, without Roosevelt behind a bill like that, the bill dies. It's also a larger problem in that it says to the world that the Nazi distaste for Jews is absolutely the one that the rest of the world endorses. And the Jews were the victims of this because the Nazis said, look, nobody wants the Jews. I mean, they even had a headline like that. Who wants the Jews? No one was their headline. So the moral that they drew from the fact that no developed country was willing to allow the entry to these refugees was that the German policy of forced expulsion and hatred and persecution and the removal of civil rights and all that was absolutely correct, that the rest of the world didn't mind. So that was the terrible thing. But, of course, you have to say, always, with all acts, that the person who is responsible is the person who performed the act. So in the case of the building of those death factories and everything, that had nothing to do with Roosevelt or Churchill or anybody other than the people who ordered the building of the factory and who built the death factory. So you never wants to remove responsibility from the actual perpetrators. But it's a sad thing that several junctures early in the war, that if there had been some kind of ceasefire and a reopening of the borders, because obviously wars close borders, that I think that hundreds and hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people who wanted to escape could have escaped. And maybe the war would have resumed, you know? But a few windows of truce can change the emotional landscape so much. And that didn't happen. And that the blame for that has to be put on the fact that Hitler obviously was a maniac, but also that both the great war leaders, Roosevelt and Churchill, were much more interested in fighting Hitler with arms and bombers than they were in allowing Jews into their own countries.
And I would even go further from the record that you lay out in your book, Human Smoke, and that is that they, in some way, needed to keep those borders closed. They wanted that war. I mean, you speak about Pearl Harbor, for example. Another example in the book, you know, growing up, I always thought Pearl Harbor was such a surprise. But in fact, Roosevelt was well aware of the possibility, in fact, the probability of an attack on Pearl Harbor, and was probably delighted when it came. Is that too strong?
I think that it's essentially right. I think it's an inescapable conclusion if you look at any of the long, long history of warnings that were published, by the way, and carefully translated and published in the New York Times, when some Japanese leader would give a speech saying, if the United States cuts off oil to Japan, Japan must choose extreme methods. And then what's the next step is that Roosevelt announces that all oil shipments to Japan are cut off. Japan is surrounded. It was a definite interest on the part of Roosevelt for his whole life in the rivalry between the great Japanese Navy and the United States Navy. Roosevelt was quintessentially a Navy man. The White House was jam-packed with models of ships and paintings of ships, and he had ship regalia all over his desk, and he was first and foremost a Navy man. And the confrontation was, in his mind, I think, almost inevitable between the Japanese Navy and the United States Navy. So there's that, and then there's this fact that it also was a way of getting the American populace unhappy. But I think that whether he was delighted when the specifics of the attack came back to him, I think that we don't know that, and I can't imagine that he wouldn't be anything but horrified at the fact that so many Navy men died. I mean, I think he needed it to hurt, and that the entire fleet, with a few exceptions, was clustered there in a very bombable, concentrated little place in Pearl Harbor. But I don't think anyone expected the ship to go down with so many men on it and for it to be that bad.
You know, it's interesting. You also talk about Roosevelt's For Freedom speech, a very famous speech. And I had to think, as I was reading that section of the book, thinking back to Victor Klemperer again, the Jewish academic. He was a philologist, a studier of words, who lived in Dresden, and in fact, amazingly enough, was saved by the firebombing of Dresden.
Yes.
Now, he worked on this book, which was published post-war, called The Language of the Third Reich, the distortion of language that occurred under that kind of totalitarian regime. And yet the same distortion of language also occurred in Britain and the U.S. Tell us what the Four Freedoms speech of Roosevelt was and what you were getting at when you discuss it in your book.
Well, it's a very powerful speech. Freedom from want, freedom from fear. It was a rousing speech. And the last kind of buttress was a call for disarmament. And it's always useful to read the whole speech by a leader. The speech includes the desire, a ringing need to build ships, tanks, and bombs. And the notion is that world disarmament will not be possible until the United States devotes most of its industrial might to the making of weapons. And that's really what had already happened. And America was just retooling. Whole factories were going up in Detroit, built by Ford. Ford, who was the kind of quintessential anti-Semite, is now that it becomes an industrial project, leaps on board and is building the B-24 bomber in order to be part of the war effort. So the bizarre thing is that, yes, that the language, this high-sounding language, then becomes completely distorted and part of something that is the opposite of itself. And it happens over and over again. It's natural. But still worth, I think, pausing and looking at a noble speech, a noble sentiment, and realizing what was going on simultaneously with that.
And he, in the Four Freedoms, the freedom of speech at the same time as those who were speaking against the war were being imprisoned for a year or more, freedom of religion, well, perhaps that was allowed here, but there was certainly a fair amount of anti-Semitism. Freedom from want and freedom from fear, these are all things that at the same time, of course, were being undermined by Roosevelt's policies himself.
Oh, well, that's true. Freedom from fear for whom? At the same time that, to go back to Churchill for a moment, in addition to wanting to change the British policy of restraint in its bombing of Germany, the first action that Churchill discussed with his new war cabinet when he assumed power in May 1940 was a very large roundup of aliens and suspect persons. The first thing that he said that he wanted to do was to put German nationals who had come to England in jail. Most of those people, the vast majority of them, were Jews. So despite all of the high-sounding rhetoric about democracy and everything else, the actual action of the British government was to put the people who had already suffered under one dictatorship into jail. So over and over again, that's, I think, true, is that there's a use of language to make something sound great in honor of abstract words. As Dorothy Day said, abstract words like democracy and liberty. But what it really comes down to is the suspension of civil rights, the building of bombers, and the desire, really, to kill as many people as possible who are defined as the enemy.
Another thing that your book, and I'm talking with Nicholson Baker about his book, Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization. Pacifism, you know, you surprised me at the beginning, at the top of this interview, where you said you weren't putting forward a pacifist prescription, and yet it does, I thought, in reading your book, that you were taking a pacifist stand.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about that.
Yeah.
But before getting to it, you talk a lot about Gandhi,
yeah.
you include many of his statements.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what to think about him because, you know, I would like to think of myself as a pacifist.
Mm-hmm.
And yet when confronted by all this, I'm not sure I am. And Gandhi's statements also just seemed to me naive in the extreme. They kind of were the stereotype of the naive pacifist. So talk a little bit about that. And what do you think of Gandhi's position?
Well, I do have a very complicated feeling about Gandhi because it's sometimes when he will say things like, he's so cheerful, you know. The thing is, how can the thing you have to understand about Gandhi is he's the main world spokesman for a country that has been bombed and occupied by a foreign country for as long as anyone can remember. And he's had many things that he thought were successes and failures, and he's still talking moderately and nonviolently, but there is a coldness. There's an oddness sometimes to his rhetoric. When he says, if the Germans want to come in, he writes to the British people, if the Germans want to come into your country, you will allow them into your homes, you will allow them to massacre anyone they want to massacre. Well, obviously, that's ridiculous, you know. But on the other hand, I think... the core of what, he's an extreme pacifist, but the core of what the pacifist that I responded most fully to were saying was something a little different, which is that if an army wants to overrun the borders, what Churchill said is, we will fight to the last, our men, our children will be slaughtered, but we will win. And so he's actually sounding a lot like Gandhi. He's just saying we're going to fight first, and then everyone will be slaughtered. But the actual notion should be, I think, if somebody wants to overrun your country, you're going to have to struggle with this, but you submit physically but not mentally because you want fewer people to die. And it's really easy to be Winston Churchill and strut around saying people will die, but people actually were dying all over Europe. And I think that is an extremely casual way of looking at suffering. And Gandhi also, in the midst of all this unhappiness in England, sounds, I think, at times way too casual about the suffering that he's talking about. But he was, very prescient in it, and he said, dignity and greatness comes from suffering voluntarily born. And there's something to that, is that what you say about what happened to Victor Klemperer is, this is a man who is suffering through a terrible time, and he assumes a kind of greatness. There is no greatness in being a bomber pilot dropping bombs on people you can't even see. There is no greatness in developing the atomic bomb and destroying Hiroshima. None of the great powers or leaders, to my mind, came out of the Second World War with any moral authority or credibility. I think the Jews, because they had to suffer through this, spoke and continue to speak with a powerful authority that is achieved through this complicated, wise response to suffering. So,
well, Nicholson Baker, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about your book, Human Smoke. It seems to me that it really puts front and center, whether we're talking about the platitudes of right, of left, of the West, of the East, of Gandhi, of Churchill, of Hitler. What your book really puts front and center is the real experience of human beings in war, both those who fight against the horror and those who submit to it and those who cause it. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me on and for asking such thought-provoking questions.
Nicholson Baker is the author of 10 other books, including the novels Checkpoint and The Mezzanine, and the nonfiction book Doublefold, Libraries and the Assault on Paper. Next up, we send out Poetry Month with an excerpt from a 2006 interview I did with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Maxine Cumin. I started out by asking her about her then-latest work, Jack and Other Poems. Now, your most recent book, is Jack your most recent poetry
Jack
volume?
Jack is my most recent book, but I'm just completing a manuscript that's coming out next September. It will be called Still to Mow. It's a wonderful quote from John Gardner, who said, "When you look back, there are lots and lots of bales in the field, but when you look ahead, it's all still to mow."
A familiar feeling.
Yes, and it seems to me maybe symbolic as well of my life.
Why is that?
Well, because I, you know, even though I'm now one of the old olds, I still feel I have a lot to say. It's all still to mow.
Going back to Jack, which is the latest book, Jack and Other New Poems,
right,
that you've published, the connection here is very, very strongly in this book, as with many of your books, with the animal world.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could read just for us, because I would really love to spend a lot of time during this interview having you read your poetry.
Okay. All right. I have a copy of Jack. What did you want?
Well, what I'd really love is just to start out by telling us, first of all, something about who Jack was.
Uh-huh. Well, I think the poem pretty much says who Jack was, but I can expatiate upon that a little.
Okay.
He came into our lives in a rather strange way. He belonged to a teenager, and he was an only horse on the property, and he kept leaving. That is to say, he found ways to get out, and he would walk down the highway, but he was very careful to stay very close to the edge of the highway, to the next farm. And eventually, she lost interest, and a home was needed for him. And we're usually the repository. When a home is needed, it's usually our home. So that was how he came into our lives, and he was, I have to say this about him, we had a brand new foal, who had been rejected by her mother, and she had to be raised as an orphan foal. And he just became her uncle. He took her everywhere. You could see him out in the pasture, and he would nudge her as if to say, "Come on, kid, it's time to go in and get a drink of water." And then she would obediently follow him in. He was a wonderfully safe horse, but very uncomfortable to ride because he had extremely straight pasterns. And when you posted, you could feel it in your cheekbones. So we didn't really have a lot of use for him, but we loved him and we kept him around, and that's where this poem, this is my guilt poem, Francesca.
Your guilt poem?
My guilt poem. I think everybody has something they feel guilty about forever.
Mm.
And this is my guilt poem. So I will now read it. Jack. How pleasant the yellow butter melting on white kernels, the meniscus of red wine that coats the inside of our goblets, where we sit with sturdy friends as old as we are after shucking the garden's last silver queen and setting husks and stalks aside for the horses, the last two of our lives still noble to look upon, our first foal now a bossy mare of 28, which calibrates to 84 in people years, and my chestnut gelding, not exactly a youngster at 22. Every year, the end of summer, lazy and golden, invites grief and regret. Suddenly, it's 1980, winter batters us, winds strike like cruelty out of Dickens. Somehow we have 7 horses for 6 stalls. One of them, a big-nosed roan gelding, calm as a president's portrait, lives in the rectangle that leads to the stalls. We call it the motel lobby. Wise old campaigner, he dunks his hay in the water bucket to soften it, then visits the others who hang their heads over their Dutch doors. Sometimes he sprawls out flat to nap in his commodious quarters. That spring, in the bustle of grooming and riding and shoeing, I remember I let him go to a neighbor I thought was a friend, and the following fall she sold him down the river. I meant to, but never did go looking for him to buy him back, and now my old guilt is flooding this twilit table. My guilt is ghosting the candles that pale us to skeletons, the ones we must all become in an as yet unspecified order. Oh, Jack, tethered in what rough stall alone, did you remember that one good winter?
Now, you said that that's your guilt poem, and
yes.
I wonder, when you read it, and you must read it quite a lot or be asked to read it, does that guilt come up again?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
So it's a painful thing to
read.
Yeah,
I feel very bad about what I failed to do, my sin of omission. I found it very hard to believe that this young woman would do such a thing. I was just incredulous when she told me.
Yeah. And down the river means?
She sold him to who knows? Mm-hmm. She sold him to somebody.
Yeah. Well, you know, that kind of gets to one of the questions that I had for you. Your poetry looks full face on some very difficult and painful things. There are the themes in your poetry, I mean, the beautiful connection. The connection to the natural world is one that brings both great joy and great pain, considering the state of the natural world these days.
Right.
And a lot of your poetry, for example, in Nurture, the poem Nurture, as well as in the poetry volume Nurture, you take up the theme of what is going on with the planet, how animals are being destroyed, how species are being destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that pains me whenever I read or listen to a report on the radio or something that talks about the death of a species. I feel it viscerally.
Yes, I agree. So do I.
And often it's too painful for me to really remain there. I switch to another channel. I turn to a different page. But when I read the poems in Nurture, I was able to look full face at this through the medium of your poetry. And I wonder if you could talk about that. In what way can poetry enable us to contemplate the horror in a way that doesn't destroy us?
Well, it's a delicate balance between, you know, writing a polemic and writing a poem. How it operates upon the individual, I think it has to operate artistically. In other words, it has to be a good poem. Then it can convey a message. And I've been particularly taken with this kind of, what shall I call it, not quite conflict, but the difficulty of bringing the two together. In the new book, Still to Mow, there are a whole series of torture poems. And my way of handling it was to write in form. One is a villanelle, one is a pantoum. I mean, to use these archaic old forms to talk about entering houses at night, for example, or what you do to the ghost prisoner. That really was a dilemma. I think it exists on any level. Anything that goes beyond the simply lyrical has to engage with the world as it is. And I guess Nurture is one poem that does. There are a lot of others. I'm thinking of With the Caribou. Many of the poems in the volume Nurture do this, but having just found it, I'll be happy to read this poem if you'd like.
I'd love to have you do that, but I also would like to ask you to tell us what a pantoon and a villanelle.
Oh, come on. Well, the villanelle is an old French form, and it's written in three-line stanzas, and the first line and the third line of the first stanza have to get repeated in a certain order. And then the final stanza is four lines. So you have two open lines, and then you have to use your first line and your third line to complete it. So, you know, technically it's a challenge, but for me, form is always so liberating. When I have something hard to say, I seem invariably to wander into this difficulty. Now, the pantoum is an old Malaysian form, but again, there's the issue of the repeat. The first and third lines of the first quatrain appear as the second and fourth lines of the second quatrain, and so on and so on and so on. It can be as long or as short as you want it to be. But why I do this, or why I write sonnets, it's just in my bloodstream. And besides, I'm old, and I grew up on formal poetry, and I love formal poetry. I mean, I love poetry that dares to rhyme and that dares to use meter, but at the same time kind of hides the fact that it's doing this. In other words, I'm not interested in a poem where the rhymes chime and chime and chime. I'm interested in slant rhyme, approximate rhyme, surprisingly apt rhymes, but actually the poem Nurture is written in free verse.
I'd love to have you read that poem then.
Okay, Nurture. From a documentary on marsupials, I learned that a pillowcase makes a fine substitute pouch for an orphaned kangaroo. I am drawn to such dramas of animal rescue. They are warm in the throat. I suffer, the critic proclaims, from an overabundance of maternal genes. Bring me your fallen fledgling, your bummer lamb. Lead the abused, the starvelings, into my barn. Advise the hunted deer to leap into my corn. And had there been a wild child, filthy and fierce as a ferret, he is called in one 19th century account, a wild child to love, it is safe to assume, given my fireside inked with paw prints, there would have been room. Think of the language we two, same and not same, might have constructed from sign, scratch, grimace, grunt, vowel, laughter, our first noun, and our long verb, howl.
Poet Maxine Cumin. Her latest book, published in 2007, is Still to Mow. Well, that's it this week for Writer's Voice. Please join us next week when we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Eric Lischblau about Bush's Law, the remaking of American justice. Also, energy politics analyst Michael Clare tells us about his newest book, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet. If you want to listen again to this show or to any other, visit our website at writersvoice.net. There you can find links to our authors, find out what's coming up on the show, send us your comments, and subscribe to our podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.